This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We are slated to visit with Loyola University Law Professor Andrea Armstrong. She'll look at 25 deaths in the East Baton Rouge Parish Prison in a five-year period between 2012 and 2016. Attorneys Mike Wolf and Bill Grimley are here to comment on the validity of non-disclosure agreements in the White House. There's a big controversy over one signed by Omarosa. Wolf and Grimley will also discuss the removal of the security clearance for former CIA Director John Brennan by the president and the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. The jury is still out. And New Orleans singer Philip Manuel will reflect on the rich musical legacy of Aretha Franklin. The Queen of Soul died Thursday in Detroit at the age of 76. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Inside the Baton Rouge area, you could save a few digits and dial 297-5633, and you can always send an email to talk at talklouisiana.org. We begin with Loyola University Law Professor Andrea Armstrong. Professor Armstrong has co-authored a report on deaths in the East Baton Rouge Parish Prison from 2012 to 2016 as part of her work with the Promise of Justice Initiative. There were 25 deaths in the parish prison in a five-year period, according to the report, exceeding the national average by a good margin. Good morning, Professor Armstrong.
Good morning.
What is your assessment after sifting through the data and surveying the landscape as far as the issues that are still present in your judgment in the parish prison right now?
There is clearly a crisis that's happening in East Baton Rouge Parish Prison. And it's atypical when we look at mortality rates across the nation. And so that crisis, though, is preventable. What we saw is failures to provide medical care, failures to provide supervision. But I think what's also interesting is failure to train the correctional staff in how to address medical complaints, right? So some of it we could say, yes, this person was not treated for X, Y, and Z. But then we have to ask why, right? Why weren't they treated? Was it because a doctor actually saw them? Or a nurse practitioner actually saw them, or was it because a custodial guard didn't get them to the medical unit in time, or even listen to their complaints and understand what was going on? And so the research over this four-year period just shows failures at every level, and the question is, what do we do now about it?
877-217-5757 for Professor Andrea Armstrong from Loyola University. The 25 deaths at the parish prison between 2012 and 2016 mean it's a death rate 2.5 times the national average. There are many people who come in and out of that prison. 1,500 people a day are housed there. So there are a lot of people, and some would say, well, if you have that many people, you're bound to have some deaths independent of whether people are being treated appropriately or not. How do you respond, Professor?
Again, I think the national averages really tell us something, right? So in 2014, which is the midpoint of this study, 80% of jails nationwide reported zero deaths, zero. The other part that I would say is that the research showed that people, the 25 who died, one of them died a few days after being detained. One of them died 31 months after being detained. And so, yes, people are coming in and out, but jails also hold people under Louisiana's practices for beyond average lengths of stay because the majority of them are pending trial, i.e. they haven't been convicted. They're not serving a sentence. They are simply waiting for a jury to assess the charges against them.
In this case, these men largely are not old men. They are young men. What is the general cause of death? Is it natural causes or something other than that?
None of these deaths are natural causes. Not one of them are natural causes. What we see is that there were two suicides, and so the youngest, a boy, you know, Tyron, was assaulted and ultimately killed, right? We also have, Lamar Johnson, who killed himself. So we have two suicides, two kind of violent or at least use of force types of claims, and then the rest are related to different types of medical conditions. So in one case, we see an intersection between the mental health issues and the death, because his mental illness prevented him from taking the sickle cell anemia medicine, mm-hmm. right? But there are procedures in place in other jails where people can be involuntarily medicated pursuant to an examination by a psychiatrist and a doctor. And these are things that our own Treatment Advocacy Center, which is a statewide center here in Louisiana, have recommended for people who are suffering from mental illness and also happen to be in jail or prison.
Casey Rayburn-Hicks, the spokesperson for the Sheriff's Office, challenges the claims that you're making. She says the majority of the deaths have been the result of poor health and pre-existing conditions, some of which result from the effects of drug addiction or prolonged drug use among inmates. Your response, Professor?
Well, I think the first point is, that none of them, unlike other jails and prisons in Louisiana, most notably New Orleans, none of these died during a detox procedure, right? So if someone comes in and they've admitted that they used drugs that day, so for example, in New Orleans, Kentrell Hurst admitted that she had used heroin earlier that day and was put on a detox protocol, right, which is a supervised withdrawal from the drug. None of these 25 died during a detox protocol. So I'm not sure why we're even talking about their possible drug addictions, since, that happens outside the walls. I think the other point, though, is people come into jail as they are, right? Some of them are picked up on traffic tickets. Some of them are picked up on more serious charges. And the jail's obligation is not to just keep healthy people healthy, but to take people as they arrive. And because individuals aren't free, so if you're arrested, you can't then call your own doctor and say, I need my prescription. So they have an obligation to treat people as they walk in the door. And that mm-hmm. includes basic things. So for example, one of the individuals who died because he didn't receive his insulin, right? That's a pretty basic thing. And the manner of death when you're dying from not receiving your insulin is particularly painful. And that was unnecessary. And the sheriff's office and the medical staffing at the jail can do better.
877-217-5757 is your number. And we're going to spend a few more minutes with Andrea Armstrong, who is with Loyola University, and she is involved intricately in this study of conditions at the East Baton Rouge Parish Prison. 25 people died inside the parish prison between 2012 and 2016, an inmate death rate of 2.5 times the national average. Do you have any indication that things are getting better in the year and a half since then?
Well, we don't have any indication that things are getting better, although we do see that, the city council is engaging. They changed the contract for one of the medical providers. We think that people are starting to have this conversation, which is the first step towards fixing things. But what I will say is that, the reason that we have this data and research is because Shanita Ferris at the Promise of Justice Initiative, who is my co-author, and the organization that really took on this study with zero funding, just because they saw a problem and needed to document it, they got this information through filing public records requests. This is not something the sheriff does not share or the city council does not share this information in a transparent or an accountable way. And instead, it took an attorney digging through files, literally mm-hmm. receiving hundreds and hundreds of pages and having to sort through to really understand who is dying, why are they dying, and what are the things that we can change? And so what I haven't seen is an increase in transparency or an accountability for the deaths that have happened.
All right, Tracy at the Capitol has a question about insurance costs, and I see that you have addressed this in your report about the rising cost of caring for these inmates. Is that based on the fact that there is this problem that we're having with fatalities?
Well, so if you're talking about the insurance premiums that are being paid, right, so every governmental entity has to have some sort of insurance. The insurance company hasn't disclosed to us why the rates have increased so drastically, but what we can see is they have, right? A 71% increase in the premium that's paid. That's the amount that, like, for example, when you pay your car insurance, right, if you pay it on an annual basis, you get a set sum that covers you for the year. Theirs, since 2011, 2012, has increased 71%. And if I were the insurer, I would certainly be looking at the types of claims and settlements that are coming through. And, you know, with 25 deaths, that's 25 investigations that the insurance company should be conducting.
Is this an aberration, or do we have other problems at jails in Louisiana?
Well, Louisiana statewide is not great in this regard either. What we know is that statewide, we are a leader per capita in jail deaths.
877-217-5757 is your number. In just a few moments, we'll hear from attorneys Mike Wolf and Bill Grimley about what's going on with the White House. Is the legal wheels churn there? And Paul Manafort, the former campaign chair for the president, is on trial, and we're waiting for a verdict. We're back after this time out with more from Professor Armstrong. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill is producing, and a few more minutes with Professor Andrea Armstrong of Loyola University. She's involved with a group called the Promise of Justice Initiative, and in a study of the East Baton Rouge Parish Jail, it was found that 25 men died inside the parish prison between 2012 and 2016, an inmate death 2.5 times the national average. And based on your study, what can be done in the near term, some quick solutions, if any, to this? What needs to be done imminently, Professor?
So the first is the city council and the sheriff need to be more transparent with the families of the people who have died, right? So the autopsy results, for example, for some of these family members haven't been released, and they're sealed. And so there are parents, there are mothers who are asking, why did my child even die, years after the fact? And so the first is to really engage with the families and the community around what's happening. And I think most of the solutions should come from that group. But I think there's some very immediate things that they can do, immediate training for their custodial staff on how to address suicide and how to address medical complaints. That is essential. Second, we really need to think about what mental health programming looks like. And that means having people on site, but it also means thinking about whether they belong in a jail in the first place. And so, you know, statewide, we're seeing cities change their practices around who they detain, who they decide needs to be in jail. And what I would say is that there's a large number of people in that jail who don't need to be there.
Well, we thank you for joining us. And this story obviously has some tentacles that will go on for some time, and it'll be eager. I'll be eager, and I'm sure our listening audience will as well, to see what the reports are for the years 2017 and 2018 about deaths at the parish prison. Professor Armstrong, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We're joined in studio now by two erudite attorneys, both of whom practice locally and have done so for many years. Michael Wolf, who is the godfather of the Libertarian Party, and moved to New York for a few years, and he's back in earnest in his hometown of Baton Rouge. And Bill Grimley, who's been with us a few times, not only a recognized lawyer, but an accomplished author as well. And we're going to cover some ground with them. And again, your number is 877-217-5757. And let's start with the non-disclosure agreement that is in the news right now. According to reports, much of the campaign non-disclosure agreement signed by those who worked for then-candidate Donald Trump are unenforceable, but the First Amendment comes into play. And the president, of course, is pointing to a non-disclosure agreement signed by Omarosa Manigault Newman, who was fired unceremoniously this week, and says she's in violation of this. And he, according to reports, has even floated the idea of the attorney general arresting her. Mike Wolf, let's begin with you. What do you make of this? Is this much ado about nothing, or is it a significant dispute?
Well, both, I think. We have to see what's going to happen, obviously. The question of non-disclosure agreements and their enforceability is based on the First Amendment, as you've mentioned. I haven't researched it in detail. I believe Bill Grimley has, though, a little bit more and can tell us more about that. But I understand that the jurisprudence has held, that is the case law, that non-disclosure agreements cannot be enforced against government officials, making it a distinction between private employees and public employees. And so I assume that that would be the outcome of this dispute.
Well, and it also was signed during the campaign before she became a government official. But these kinds of things are done in business in many places. And Mike, you actually pulled the agreement. Michael Wolf has a copy of the agreement. Is there anything in there that is prominent, or is it basically a boilerplate agreement that was signed?
It's boilerplate, but it's very comprehensive. And for example, it applies not just to the campaign or to the employment period, but for any period thereafter. So it would attempt to cover any subsequent activity of this lady's after the campaign.
But it is a totally different world being Becca, being in a campaign and being a member of the White House staff. So there's a major distinction there.
Well, right, and it brings up the question of loyalties and contractual obligations. People have been saying in the media over the last couple of days that the employees of the White House are employees of the government and of the people at large, so they can't be confined by an employer as they could in a private context. But again, I'd like to hear Mr. Grimley's opinion about that.
Mr. Grimley's also been looking at this agreement. What are your thoughts? Does the president have a case?
Well, let's understand and remember that it's the campaign that's bringing the arbitration. And I think the reason that the campaign is doing it and not the White House is because Mike is right that you can only limit government employees and what they talk about after they leave government employment to classified information. Well, they're trying to do an end run on that, and they're trying to do indirectly what they cannot do directly, which is, you know, to silence this lady, and hence the campaign brings the arbitration.
And the president would probably prefer arbitration to depositions. I don't think he wants to be deposed, and if that were to happen, he would be taking the risk of being asked about a lot of other things.
I'm not sure to what extent you can do discovery in arbitration. It may be up to the arbitrator, but I don't know of any
reason. Much different than a deposition, I would think.
Well, discovery includes the deposition. So, yes, the president could be called. But the question is, in arbitration, can you do normal discovery, which would include depositions?
Mike, do you?
Yeah, I don't know. I am not an expert in arbitration. But in general, the procedures are less confining. That's why many companies and organizations put binding arbitration clauses in contracts, because arbitration is easier for defendants to handle than litigation.
877-217-5757 is your number. David in Atlanta. David, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. You know, John Brennan, I'm sure y'all probably discussed this already, played a significant role in the killing of Osama bin Laden. And now President Trump, for his petty, selfish reasons to promote his ego, because his feelings were hurt by Mr. Brennan, is not looking for the interests of the country, but his own selfish satisfaction to carry out his hate agenda. He wants to be, or he's president, to pad his businesses and his family.
All right. Now, that was topic number two, but John Brennan, the former CIA director, has had his security clearance removed, and we intended to talk to Grimley and Wolf about this. Becca, before we do that, since David brought it up, let's go to a cut from Senator John Neely Kennedy, our junior senator from Louisiana, who thinks that removing the security clearance for Director Brennan is a great idea. Here is Senator Kennedy.
I think most Americans look at our national intelligence experts as being above politics. Mr. Brennan has demonstrated that that's not the case. He's been totally political. I think I called him a butthead, and I meant it. I think he's given the national intelligence community a bad name.
All right. He called Director Brennan, Bill Grimley, a butthead, Senator Kennedy did. Your thoughts about the choice of words from our junior senator?
Well, it's offensive, and maybe we should elevate the discussion in Washington that's been going down the tubes for the past few years.
Mike Wolf, would you be offended if somebody called you a butthead?
No, but obviously the rhetoric has gotten uncivil. But one of the problems I think Brennan did that helped produce this was that he accused President Trump of treason for his press conference in Helsinki with Putin. And I think that was an overstatement. Treason, accusations of treason shouldn't be thrown around lightly. That sounded like the kind of thing Trump would say. And that was very blameworthy on Brennan's part.
Well, Brennan is no longer a government official, though. He's a pundit, and he may have truly believed it was treason. Let's talk about that some more. 877-217-5757. We're back after the news from Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. Another segment with attorneys Mike Wolf and Bill Grimley. And they're talking about what's going on nationally. And, of course, as we know, that always has some application on what's happening in Louisiana. The president is trying to enforce a non-disclosure agreement signed during his campaign by the lady he fired, Omarosa Manigault Newman, and he has removed the security clearance of John Brennan, the former CIA director, and gives every indication that he'll remove the others, many others, and Senator Kennedy is lauding the president, saying that Brennan is, quote, a butthead. 877-217-5757. We're going to go back to the lines quickly, but before we go, Paul Manafort, the former campaign chair of the president, is on trial. Some thought this was a slam dunk, but it appears the jury is deliberating earnestly. They went through a full day without a decision, even though Manafort's team did not even present a defense. Bill Grimley, any thoughts about where this is going?
I think not calling any witnesses was a bold move on the part of the defense. In my experience, what that means is they really didn't have a defense. And they want to hope that maybe there's something about the trial that will accrue to their benefit. I think Rick Gates actually probably is going to be a pretty good asset for the defense, interestingly enough, for a number of reasons, one of which is that when the prosecutor flips a co-defendant and they get a great deal, the jury thinks, well, maybe that's unfair.
All right. Dusty. In Sherwood Forest. Dusty, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to, I don't think you are discussing that subject right now. It's about Senator Kennedy calling the former CIA director a butthead, but he never said anything about what the president said in, about the America when he was there with the Russian president in Helsinki. I want to see what, you know, your guest had to say about that.
Senator Kennedy never criticized the president?
Right.
Okay, well, I think that has some political calculus to it. The president got 58% of the votes in Louisiana. He's a Republican. Kennedy's a Republican. The president has supported John Kennedy. Will likely be at his side next year if Kennedy is running for governor. So the last thing the senator is going to do is to criticize the man who brought him to the dance when he was campaigning for Senate against Foster Campbell. There was Donald John Trump right at John Kennedy's side. I would say hell will freeze over, Mike Wolf, before you'll hear John Kennedy criticize the president.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. But remember what the president said. Basically, he said, I don't know why Russia would interfere in our elections, as Putin had denied doing, and as our intelligence services have insisted they did do, and as I think most people believe they did. He was obviously kissing Putin's butt, and I think it's hard to call that treason, basically. It was dumb, but he was basically being sycophantic to Putin, just trying to be nice to him, basically, exaggerating his belief in Russia's innocence.
Well, the president has acknowledged that he fired Comey, his FBI director, because of the Russia probe, and he has also acknowledged that he took Brennan's security clearance away from him because of Russia as well. So if you want to get on the president's last nerve, criticize him about Russia.
Well, yes. It brings up an interesting question. Well, the whole structure of the independent counsel law is difficult to enforce and to carry out against an uncooperative president, because the president is the head of the executive branch, the Justice Department, and so forth. And it's always hard to have a president investigate himself. Really, the main remedy is impeachment for presidential misconduct.
877-217-5757, Jim on O'Neill. Jim, good morning. You're on with Bill Grimley and Mike Wolf. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, gentlemen. After the Helsinki treasonous statements, and I'm sorry, I happen to think they absolutely were, we've got trying to silence the media. We've got trying to silence critics. I'm sorry. I think it's about time, after all the erratic behavior, for President Erdogan, I'm sorry, Trump's, there's really not a difference, remove his security clearance for the exact same reason he's claiming that they should remove Brennan.
All right, remove the president's security clearance. Don't see that happening. But, Bill, Mike Wolf says this was not treasonous, the president's actions in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin. Do you think it was?
No, I don't think it was treasonous. It was unfortunate and probably reflects on the guilty mind of the president. But let's go back to Brennan and the removal of his clearance. It was a juvenile thing to do. It doesn't accomplish anything. The man was not getting security briefings. It was vindictive and childish. And
unprecedented.
Well, and unprecedented according to a lot of newspapers yesterday. So Kennedy's remarks are unfortunate and vulgar, but also misplaced.
All right. Rebecca asked about several news organizations coming together after being called enemy of the people. They don't like that, and for good reason, but that's how the president is terming the media. Your thoughts about the war that's going on between the Fourth Estate and the President of the United States?
It's just despicable. I mean, for 250 years, we've depended on the media, people like you, to inform us. Every morning I wake up, I turn on the media to find out what the truth is. And by and large, it's always accurate. And when it's not, they retract. It's a very reliable source. It's an attack upon the First Amendment when our president attacks the media.
Well, he does use the mantra fake news continuously. And this is from a president who received over $1 billion in free media during his 2016 campaign. He has benefited from the media. He certainly manipulates the media with these tweets every morning, and it just defines the news cycle and lets it go in the direction he wants. But there are so many investigations ongoing. Mike Wolf, it's hard to keep track of them. Is it a case of which there is just too much to follow, or is it a case in which people, the media, the government, you name it, they're all piling on the President of the United States? What do you think?
I don't think they're piling on, but it is everything suffers by dilution. When accusations multiply, each individual one seems less important because it's like an echo effect, and that is going on with President Trump and his White House, but obviously we have to keep paying attention to them, and the media is doing its job by calling attention to this all this horrible behavior.
Well, just to follow up on what Mike said. I wrote something yesterday about the number of scandals that we have to deal with on a weekly, daily basis. And my thought was that if you wanted to hide a button, you would throw it into a bushel of buttons. And we were just overwhelmed by what's going on. But I think it's a real mistake to think that Trump has any purpose or plan here. Tony, what's his, Swartz, that ghosted his Art of the Deal, said, don't attribute plan or method to Trump. It's all ego and impulse.
Well, it's worked well for him. He is the president. He's a billionaire. He's done rather well. He's had some setbacks, as we know, with four bankruptcies. But his way of conducting business has not been unsuccessful for him. Gustavo says, if John Brennan is not a government official, why does he even need a security clearance?
Well, the reason that's often given is that these guys retain their clearance so that those who have taken their place can turn to them for advice and insight. Well, now we've lost that insight with Brennan.
If Manafort is found not guilty or if there is a hung jury, will this be a victory for the president? I would imagine he would do what a good politician would do and claim victory. Your thoughts?
Well, he'll stand on the White House roof and crow. And the next thing he will do, number two, will be to fire Mueller.
You think?
It'll embolden him.
Mike?
I don't waste time with predictions of that kind. I say, let's see what happens.
Well, the president, I would think, would be emboldened if Manafort, despite what some believe is a slam dunk case. But it is analogous to what happened with O.J. Simpson. A lot of these pundits thought that was a slam dunk case, too, and look what happened. There may not be a guilty verdict coming out. We'll see. But I don't think it's 100%. If it were, they would have already reached a verdict.
Well, and you will recall that when they started their deliberations, they asked four questions, one of which was, please redefine reasonable doubt. And that could be read two ways. There might be a couple of jurors who are not convinced, or it could be that they're all entertaining reasonable doubt.
Well, we'll see what happens. It's a fascinating world in which we live, and there was thought that Manafort did not present a defense because he's counting on a presidential pardon. Mike and Bill, the president has been accused of misusing the pardon power he has. Is that fair to make that claim?
I think it is, yes. It addresses questions of judgment and prudence, as we were discussing in another context a moment ago. Yes, even though he's got the power, it may not be a wise thing to do, and like firing Comey or potentially firing Mueller and so forth. So, he can pardon at willy-nilly. But
Bill Grimley?
Well, the thing that comes to mind is that in all these pardons that he's given, he's circumvented the normal process. Justice, the DOJ usually reviews applications for pardons, and that hasn't happened here. So I don't know whether I would say he's abused the process. Yeah.
Should he pardon Billy Cannon?
Who knows? Bill, posthumous pardons?
Yes.
I guess like he did.
He did it for Jack Johnson?
Yes, he did it for Jack Johnson.
For Jack Johnson. Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll be back after this timeout. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill is our producer, and we're about to be joined by the fabulous singer from the great city of New Orleans, Philip Manuel. And today, as yesterday, America and the world are mourning the loss of a giant of music, Aretha Franklin. Today's New York Times appropriately has her above the fold, front page, Aretha Franklin, 1942 to 2018. And the story from Wesley Morris starts, officially, Respect is a relationship song. That's how Otis Redding wrote it. But love wasn't what Aretha Franklin was interested in. The opening line is, what you want, baby, I got it. But her want, her what, is a punch in the face. Miss Franklin's rearrangement was about power, and she had the right to be respected by some dude, perhaps by her country, just a little bit. So Aretha Franklin leaves quite a legacy, and I'm sure we'll hear her music long after today. But today, if you listen to the radio, you're going to hear a lot of Aretha. And Philip Manuel, that's not a bad thing, is it?
No, that's a very good thing, man, an absolutely good thing. How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing well. That song, as mentioned, was written by Otis Redding, who died, as we know, tragically 50 years ago. But he was a great singer, sitting on the dock of the bay, and what a voice he had. But Aretha made it her signature song, and for those who haven't heard it, and you probably have, probably very recently.
I can't imagine anybody hasn't heard Respect.
Well, let's give it a little bit of a listen. Becca, don't we? Let's cue up Aretha Franklin.
There you go.
Amazing, amazing voice, and nobody ever did that song better. And she took other songs that were famous with artists and made them her songs. And Philip Manuel, you're a little over a decade younger than Aretha, but just as she became famous, you were probably entering your formative years when you decided to be a singer. I'm sure she had quite an influence on you.
You know, I was thinking, Jim, what I would say today. And do you know the movie Troy with Brad Pitt? He plays Achilles in this movie, Troy.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I'm familiar with.
At the end of the movie, the guy who's telling the story throughout the movie, you know, Achilles is dead, and you hear his voice come up as the music rises, and he says something to the effect of, "When history records my life, let them say that I lived in the days of Hector, or I lived in the days of Achilles." And I thought, you know what? I am glad to have lived in the days of Aretha. You know, I really am. And you're absolutely right. I mean, Aretha was right in my formative years. There was no way, not that you would want to, but there was no way to escape her. She was, you know, every now and then the good Lord just puts all of the right things together, all the components together to manifest some sort of greatness or something profound. And Aretha, she was the recipient of that. First, you know, that singular talent, that supremely gifted voice of hers. And then it was the right time. It was when R&B music was making its statement. It was leaving the blues a little bit behind and putting the rhythm on it. And Aretha was just the perfect spokesperson for that. And then you had Jerry Wexler, the guy who produced her. And then you had the right songs. So, man, it was like, you know, it was a cocktail that just couldn't go wrong. And she deserved every bit of success that she had.
Did you ever see her in person perform?
I'm trying to think. I might have seen Aretha once later in her life at Essence or where was it? I don't recall where it was, but I think I had seen her once. But it was later in her life.
Mm-hmm. Well, she had a lot of health problems. And in a bit, we'll read part of a essay in the New York Times, a column from Bob Herbert that was written 8 years ago, in which he said she was battling pancreatic cancer. And at 76, you know, a lot of people die of pancreatic cancer rather quickly. She fought the good fight.
That's a long time. My grandmother died of pancreatic cancer, and I think we found out about it maybe a week before she passed.
Yeah, quite often people go quickly, but she was a warrior. And for those unfamiliar with her backstory, she owes much of her formative years, her experience with music, to gospel music. Her father was a famous minister, and Reverend Franklin, you talk about tragedy, he was shot in the head by someone who broke into his home in 1979 and remained in a coma 5 years until his death. Carolyn Franklin, who wrote the beautiful Ain't No Way for Aretha, died of cancer in 1988 at 43. And Irma Franklin, a singer who had a hit with Peace of My Heart, died in 2002. So this life was not one that was full of roses and cherries. She had her challenges, Philip.
You know, but Jim, I have to tell you, it makes for, it's a perverse sort of thing, but it makes for some unbelievable grist and angst and for some soulful music when you can take that and kind of, you know, lead it down the right path. I mean, and funnel it into the right energy. It is unfortunate, though.
Do you find that a lot of great artists, whether it be musicians, singers, comedians in particular, they've had tragedy? In many ways, it propels them into the gifts they have.
You know, I think sometimes it is. For sure, tragedy plays I think a lot of great artists have suffered the type of tragedy you're talking about. And sometimes it's shortcomings that precede greatness, if you get my drift. You know? I mean, sometimes it's the things you don't have, so you compensate in a certain way. And by compensating, you create something absolutely unique and new. I kind of think of Fats Domino that way, you know. Who was more unique than that?
That's true. What was it about her voice that was so captivating?
Well, I'm going to tell you, it transcended age, race, culture. It was truly, I mean, that word is used a lot, transcendent. But Aretha Franklin, her voice transcended every barrier, everything that could be put in the way, every wall, it was just a transcendent voice. Everybody liked it. And you hate to talk about the racial side of things, but her voice was obviously uniquely African American, but it had another kind of refinement, and that was understandable by all. Mm-hmm. You know,
she was born March 25, 1942, 30 days before Barbara Streisand, who of course also has a spectacular voice. To think that they were born less than a month apart, same year.
But in
the culture, I think Aretha is, she won 18 Grammys. She is revered even more, I hate to say this, even more than Barbara Streisand.
I think Barbara Streisand, let's make no doubt about it. I mean, she is one of the world's great singers, one of the great singers of the 20th and 21st century, no doubt. But Aretha, like I said, the timing was just so right for, and Barbara didn't necessarily have to overcome so much. Aretha overcame, and it was that and the timing and of course, like I said, that singular talent that just makes her story so special.
Well, thank you for sharing your remembrances of the great Aretha Franklin. Thank you, Philip Manuel. It's always good to talk.
It's my pleasure, Jim. Thanks for thinking of me, man.
See you soon.
All right.
And Bob Herbert, in his column of December 24, 2010, wrote this. He said, 1967 was a tough year in many respects, riots, protests, and unwinnable war, but I can't think of it without thinking of the glory of Aretha Franklin, a woman in her mid-20s, introverted and somewhat shy, who sang soul and rock and roll with the power and beauty of a heavenly choir. Newark and Detroit went up in flames in 1967. Neither city was ever to recover. Muhammad Ali, a perfect physical specimen in his absolute athletic prime, was convicted of dodging the draft, stripped of his world heavyweight championship. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King endured a hurricane of criticism when he came out publicly against the war in Vietnam. If you were lucky, you could close the door on the den, at least for a little while, and reach for the record album. With a head and shoulder shot of Aretha positioned at a precarious angle on the cover, the album was called I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You.
Stay.